Ladies and gentlemen, in the past 15 lectures, I have analyzed one sphere of human activity after another to demonstrate that man must hold reason as his only guide to action in every aspect of his life. Contrary to the claims of the mystic and neo-mystic philosophers that man cannot live by reason, it is only by reason that man can live if he is to live as man. Whatever concession such philosophers may make on other issues of human existence, there is no issue on which all the forces of the anti-mind contingents have been focused with such violent intensity, no issue they have so fiercely held close to the power of reason as the issue of sex. In no other issue have they succeeded so thoroughly. It is almost universally accepted that sex and reason are two separate or incompatible realms, that man's sexual life bears no relation to his intellect, that his sexual activity is independent of his thinking and impervious to logic, that his mind is impotent in the sphere of his sexual desires. It is not necessary to argue that sex is crucially important to human beings. We all know it, both by introspection and by our observation of others. We know that no other subject is of so intense a concern to people. We know that they think about sex, they dream about sex, they write novels about sex, they respond eagerly to any advertisements that offer them books, plays, movies, or scandal exposés about sex, they have nervous breakdowns over sex, they wreck their lives over sex, sometimes they even commit murders over sex. Everybody knows it, but nobody has explained why. What is the role of sex in man's life? The answer given by ancient sages, by modern philosophers, or by any man on the street is the same, whether stated in poetic metaphors, in medical language, or in crude vulgarities. They all declare, in effect, that the issue of sex is a self-evident, irreducible primary, requiring no explanation. Or they believe they have explained it by declaring that sex is an instinct, or that such is human nature. Such, of course, is human nature, but the question is, what is it in human nature that causes man's intense concern with sex? That is the question I shall discuss tonight. In spite of our modern culture's alleged enlightenment and scientific sophistication, the modern man's view of sex, like his code of morality, is in essence the same primordial view that infiltrated Western civilization from the mystic cults of the Orient. Metaphysically, that view regards man's nature as consisting of two opposite antagonistic elements, of soul and body, with the soul representing some higher, nobler dimension, and the body representing man's lower animal nature, which belongs to this earth. Man's values, according to this dichotomy, pertain to his soul and are not merely unrelated to, but opposed to, the actions and the needs of his body. Man's body and any pleasure he may seek on earth are base and evil by nature. Therefore, man's virtue consists of renouncing any form of material concern or sensual enjoyment, such as wealth, luxury, production, trade, sex. Sex has always been the focal point of every mystic's attack on man and on existence. Since sex is the most intense form of pleasure that man can experience, it was damned as the most sinful. It was damned as brutal, impure, unclean, evil by its very nature. Chastity, virginity, abstinence were held as virtues, the triumph of the soul over the body. Plato was the transmission belt who carried this view from the Oriental mysticism of the Orphics into Western civilization and immortalized it in the concept that bears his name, Platonic love. According to Plato, real love is a pure, selfless emotion of the spirit, untainted by any trace of selfish, physical, sexual desire. And sexual desire is an animal instinct of man's body, unrelated to the values of his spirit. Plato's dichotomy was accepted by St. Paul, by Augustine, and by all the philosophers of Christianity. In Christian culture, it became the concept of two different kinds of love called sacred and profane, with sacredness pertaining to the spirit and profanity to the body. With the evolution of Christianity across the centuries, this view of sex was somewhat modified. While the early Christian philosophers damned sex as such and regarded all sexual pleasure as sinful and evil, some of the later ones adopted a kind of metaphysical compromise. They held that sex is not sinful if sanctioned by marriage and if its primary purpose is procreation. Married people were told, in effect, that the sin of experiencing physical pleasure would be forgiven to them if and only if their primary motive was procreation, and pleasure was only an incidental, unsought, unavoidable byproduct. This was the philosopher's reluctant concession to men's lower nature. Since very few men are able to be continent, they said, and since procreation is necessary for the continued existence of the human race, and the continued existence of the human race is necessary in order to supply God with a plentiful quantity of worshippers, sexual pleasure had to be tolerated in marriage as a necessary evil. Marriage was described as a medicine for immorality. Some Christian philosophers claimed that if Adam and Eve had not fallen from grace and had remained in the Garden of Eden, they would have engaged in sexual intercourse, but it would have been an activity absolutely devoid of any sensual enjoyment, an activity undertaken solely for the purpose of cold, calculated reproduction. Not being damned, they would have had that virtuous advantage. One of the consequences of man's damnation is that he has lost the possibility of a sexual act that would achieve procreation without bringing him any pleasure. Note this particular point. It is pleasure that made sex sinful. It is pleasure that the religionists damned as evil. Now, what was the opposition offered to that view of sex? In the history of the post-Renaissance philosophy, the only opposition to that view of the spiritualists who claim that sex is evil is the view of the materialists who claim that sex is meaningless. The materialists, the modern neo-mystics, who assert that man is a mindless automaton made of meat with conditioned reflexes, the alleged champions of sex who proclaim their desire to set men free of taboos and inhibitions, defend sex in effect in the following manner. It's not true that sex is evil because it's a brute animal function. Since man is nothing but a brute animal, it's not wrong for him to engage in a brute animal function. Why shouldn't he? All his functions are brute animal functions. The only wrong is to pretend that they're anything else. Ladies and gentlemen, is this an opposition to the mystics' doctrines, or merely a deeper and uglier acceptance of the metaphysics held by the mystics, of their metaphysical view of man, the other and brassier side of the same coin? If the mystics of spirit declare that man is a swine who might have a chance to acquire some value after death, the protest of the mystics of muscle consists of declaring, sure, I'm a swine, but I belong in the muck and I don't propose to bother about any values. There are many men who think that they are rebelling against a mystical religious upbringing by embarking upon a course of mindless sexual promiscuity. They think that this demonstrates their freedom from mysticism. In fact, they have conceded the mystics' basic premise, that sex is an activity devoid of any meaning, of any spiritual or psychological significance, that is, of any values. Such are the two alternatives that men have been offered. A choice between the spiritualists and the materialists, between those who believe in values without pleasure and those who believe in pleasure without values. The spiritualists preach that man must pursue moral values, that must not expect any pleasure from them. The materialists preach that man may pursue pleasure, but must not pretend that it involves any moral values. Both accept the fundamental premise that pleasure and values have no relation to each other. In one version or another, the Orphic, Platonic, medieval view of sex still dominates our culture. Let me quote some excerpts from medieval literature written in the late part of the 19th century by doctors who should have known better on the role of sex in human life. A 19th century surgeon writes, quote, I should say that the majority of women, happily for society, are not very much troubled with sexual feeling of any kind. To maintain the contrary, to maintain that women do find sexual pleasure, is a vile aspersion. Another 19th century medical work refers to doctors who were troubled by the fact that, in certain cases, they observed unequivocal physical indications that women were not altogether indifferent to sex. Quote, physical signs of a woman's sexual responsiveness may be observed, but this only happens in lascivious women, or such as live luxuriously. Close quote. A famous 19th century German scientific authority writes, quote, it is an altogether false idea that a young woman has just as strong an impulse to the opposite sex as a young man. The appearance of the sexual side in the love of a young girl is pathological, close quote. And here is a quotation from a man who is alleged to hold advanced views on sex and to be opposed to the traditional derogation of sexual activity, Sigmund Freud. Quote, "Anyone who subjects himself to serious self-examination will indubitably find that at the bottom of his heart, he too regards the sex act as something degrading, which soils and contaminates not only the body." Close quote. No matter what part of these ideas modern men may have rejected, no matter how confidently men assert that they do not believe in the soul-body dichotomy, one consequence of the Orphic doctrine still stands unchallenged, dominating our modern culture as a monument to a very ancient evil, almost as a dark primordial temple still claiming human sacrifices in the form of lives wrecked by frustration, bewilderment, and guilt. The belief accepted by the majority of men that sex is primarily a physical function. There are many different versions of this belief and many different estimates. Not all those who hold it share the extreme materialist appraisal, which may be called brute animalism. Some people hold that sex is an animal function, but that there's nothing wrong in being an animal. In fact, it's natural or wholesome or even beautiful. Such views range from the glass of water school that regards sex as a natural physical function fulfilling a physical need of no greater significance than drinking a glass of water when one is thirsty, to the animal glamour school that regards the primitive, the instinctual, the earthy, as romantic, passionate, and colorful, in opposition to the intellectual and the civilized, which it regards as cold, effete, and dull. The school whose view of sex is best exemplified by Hollywood versions of the South Sea natives, or by current Italian movies about barefooted peasant girls. There are people who try to allow some place or influence to romantic love in the issue of sex in some undefined manner, which amounts to the belief that sex is physical, but that a good man combines it somehow with spiritual emotions of love, while a man who is less good does not, but indulges in physical promiscuity, unrelated to his mind or values or emotions. These various attitudes differ not in their metaphysical view of sex, but only in their estimates. They range in effect from the belief that sex belongs in the gutter to the belief which transfers it to the jungle, then transfers it to the bathroom, then transfers it to the bedroom of a vine-covered cottage. But the place from which sex is barred by their united front is the study. That man's mind, reason, and logic have no connection whatever with his sex life is the absolute they all hold in common. Reason, they hold, is an alien to sex. Either an impotent alien defeated by the power of irrational passion, or a destructive alien whose cold hand kills the joy that only a mindless body can experience. As one modern writer puts it, quote, "The amorous choice is not a rational act, and one may rightly feel suspicious that where choice is rational, there is probably no love," close quote. Or writes another, quote, "The moment one is able to say because, one is no longer under the spell," close quote. Now, as we shall proceed to examine the issue, let me state at the outset that, speaking metaphorically, a man's sex life is determined precisely by the hours he has spent or failed to spend in his study, by which I mean by the thinking he has done or has failed to do. Like any other activity, only if possible more so than any other activity, a man's sex life is determined by his premises, held consciously or subconsciously. And the grim joke on the mystics of both schools is that of all the aspects of man's life, sex is the most philosophical, though not in the way that they would project it. Sex is the sum, the expression, and often the nemesis of the kind of philosophy a man has chosen to accept. It is the one realm where premises most inexorably will out. To quote Francisco D'Anconia, "Tell me what a man finds sexually attractive, and I will tell you his entire philosophy of life. Show me the woman he sleeps with, and I will tell you his valuation of himself." This is what I propose to demonstrate and to explain. Now, let us start by examining the question, is sex primarily a physical function? Obviously, the capacity to experience sexual pleasure is physical in the sense that man's body possesses the appropriate nerves and organs, which are the necessary tools of that experience. But this is not the point at issue. The point is whether man's sexual apparatus is an autonomous machine that runs itself by its own will, or whether it is a tool, a machine run by man's mind, and if this last, then how, in what manner? The physicalistic view holds that sex is a purely physical phenomenon, a biological function that acts independently of a man's philosophy, of his moral values, or his intellectual pursuits. According to this view, sex is merely the need and the experience of a physical pleasure that involves nothing but physical stimulation. A man's sexual desires, preferences, and practices are determined by his body and bear no relation to his ideas or the rest of his character. If this were true, then the first unanswerable problem would be, what is the nature of the need for a partner? Why does one want to sleep with somebody? Why does one prefer heterosexual intercourse to autoeroticism or masturbation? It cannot be argued that this preference is caused by differences in physical sensations, because if we consider nothing but the physical stimulation given nerve endings, it is surely possible to duplicate to a high degree the literal nervous messages sent along the nervous system. It is not one's body that would know the difference. A few years ago, I had a male patient who held the Don Juan attitude towards sex. He insisted that sex had no particular spiritual meaning in his life, that it was simply a matter of physical release, and, as far as he was concerned, any available woman would do for that purpose. He insisted that the issue had no wider psychological significance and that nothing could be inferred from about his character from the nature of his particular sexual choices. I said to him, suppose that you were provided with a life-size rubber doll constructed as an exact replica of a woman so that your senses would not be aware of any perceptible difference. Would you give up sleeping with women and content yourself with obtaining your physical satisfaction from this doll for the rest of your life? He drew back and answered, God, no. So I asked, why not? He answered, because in sex you want a partner. Well, I asked him why this doll would not do for a partner, since it would resemble a woman in every way. He answered, yes, but in sex you want a consciousness, not just an inanimate body. It's interesting, I said. You want a consciousness, and simultaneously you maintain that this is merely an issue of physical release. What does your body know or care about a consciousness? What difference would that make to your nerve cells? Your mind knows the difference, but your mind, by your theory, plays no part in your sexual activity. At this point, he conceded that more was involved than he had hitherto acknowledged. When you are considering the validity of any theory, remember an elementary rule of scientific epistemology. To be valid, a theory must incorporate all and contradict none of the evidence relevant to the subject under consideration. And there are a great many phenomena that cannot be incorporated or explained by a physicalistic theory of sex. The first is the desire for a partner. The second is the preference exhibited by every human being for one kind of partner over another. And there is no man who does not possess some sort of sexual standards. The standards may be very crude and primitive, they may embrace a very wide, seemingly indiscriminate range, but every man draws the line somewhere. There is no man of whom it is not true that there is some woman he would prefer not to sleep with. Once we observe the universal phenomenon of sexual preferences, once we know that a man derives an intense pleasure from sleeping with one person, but not from sleeping with another, we know that the key to the difference lies in the spiritual or psychological realm, that is, in man's consciousness, not in his body. Because the physical motions involved are the same and the stimulation of nerve cells are the same, regardless of partner. If one sexual relationship produces boredom or shame and another the purest, most intense kind of pleasure, the difference lies in the realm of human psychology, not in the realm of physiology. Now, as in most issues, there exists a middle-of-the-road kind of theory of sex, the semi-physical theory, which holds that sex is not an autonomously physical issue of the body, that man's consciousness and values are involved, but that such values pertain only to the body and that one's preferences are directed by one's standards of physical beauty alone, proving, therefore, that the body is one's only concern in sex and that moral or intellectual issues or values are irrelevant. The example usually given to illustrate this theory is an experience shared by most men at one time or another of the following kind. Walking down the street, a man sees a very beautiful woman. Knowing nothing about her, with no thought and no time to think of her character, he feels an immediate sexual desire. To the best of his conscious introspective knowledge, her beautiful body was the only source and inspiration of his desires. The question to ask in such a case is, Suppose the man approached her, became acquainted, and discovered that she is a vicious murderess just released from jail, or a woman who can barely connect two sensible phrases. Would his sexual desire remain unchanged? Any semi-competent introspector would admit that his desire would vanish. I doubt whether there is a man or a woman who has not had an actual experience of this same category. The experience of feeling a romantic sexual attraction to a good-looking member of the opposite sex, which vanished on closer acquaintance when one became disappointed in that person's character or intelligence. The good looks did not change, but the attraction vanished. Who hasn't had the experience, for example, of coming to a party, seeing across the room a good-looking member of the opposite sex, feeling a spark of interest, walking over to this person, and then the person opens his or her mouth, and one feeling vanishes. The question to ask in all such cases is, what is the meaning of man's response to physical beauty? Observe that people differ in their standards of beauty and in the kind of type they find physically attractive. One's response to a person's physical appearance depends on the kind of qualities of character that appearance suggests to us. The suggestion may be valid or accidental. It may be the result of observation or of chance association. But in either case, it is character that one perceives or imagines oneself to be perceiving when one feels attracted to a certain type of physical experience. Human beings form their estimates of romantic values early in life, usually in their teens. Qualities of character are hard to define and to identify then or later. But the values of physical appearance are the easiest to perceive and to appraise. Since most people do not identify their standard of moral values and do not know consciously what character traits they value or why, their romantic estimates remain on the primitive associational level of adolescence. But whenever a man responds to a woman's physical beauty, what he is seeing is the abstraction woman. And what his subconscious is doing is endowing that abstraction with the particular qualities of character, the particular values he seeks in a woman. He seeks them only by means of his own undefined, unidentified emotional response, which he should but may never identify in conscious terms. Whenever you are attracted to a girl's pretty face, it is not villainy that you expect to find in that girl. Ask yourself what it is that you do expect to find, and you may get a clue to your actual romantic standards. As further proof of the fact that the romantic appeal of physical beauty is symbolic rather than actual, observe the fact that many women who possess a perfect physical beauty but lack character, whose personality is flat, lifeless, undistinguished, do not arouse masculine desire and are considered to lack sex appeal. On the other hand, women who are much less beautiful and sometimes actually homely often possess an enormous sex appeal. Consider the meaning of the concept of sex appeal. Few people realize that the concept is a blatant denial of the physicalistic view of sex or of the view which attributes sexual attraction to physical appearance. Sex appeal means a special quality of character, an attribute of personality. Most people say that it is an undefinable quality, an undefinable something. But most people say that about any complex emotion. Physical beauty as such is a human value, but it is far from being the crucial or the determining value in sexual attraction. Now observe another point. If a man were to make a declaration of platonic love to a woman, if he were to tell her that he adores her emotionally, but that she does not arouse any sexual desire in him, she would not believe his love, and she would feel profoundly hurt, offended, insulted. The same would be true of a man if he heard a similar declaration from a woman. Very few people are willing to accept the idea that romantic love can be divorced from any element of sexual desire, yet these same people are willing to believe that sexual desire can exist without any element of love or spiritual valuation. Sexual desire and sexual emotion are determined by a person's premises, just like any other human desire or emotion. The body cannot desire, only you can desire. And just as any other mental evaluation that produces an emotion can produce physical consequences in your body, as, for instance, an evaluation of danger can make your heart beat faster and can increase the supply of adrenaline, so certain kinds of mental evaluations can produce a feeling of sexual desire, but that feeling is no more generated by the body than any other emotion is generated by the body. Your body is only your tool. Your consciousness is the generator of the values and purposes for which you choose to employ that tool. Before we proceed to discuss the specific values involved in the issue of sex, let me remind you of the metaphysical meaning of pleasure in human life. Pleasure is man's emotional response to that which achieves, supports, or furthers his values. Suffering is his emotional response to that which threatens, injures, or destroys them. Since success in achieving his values is the basic metaphysical necessity of man's survival, the experience of pleasure is the emotional proof and confirmation of his ability to deal with existence, which means of his fitness to exist. Thus, pleasure and self-esteem are interacting corollaries in man's consciousness. Self-esteem, the confident sense of one's own ability to deal with existence, is in itself the most profound pleasure a man can experience and the root of all the others. Every experience of pleasure, major or minor, carries with it a sense of one's own efficacy, of success in achieving the desired or desirable, of success in dealing with reality. An expression or reaffirmation of self-esteem, or, to state it more precisely, a sense of efficacy is the form of inner awareness which gives man the emotional reality of his own self-esteem. Action and values are inseparable corollaries in man's life. Values to be gained or kept require action. Action is motivated, consciously or subconsciously, by the purpose of achieving or preserving a value. In relation to his values, man's actions fall into two basic categories, production and consumption. The actions he takes to achieve a value and the actions he takes to use it. The simplest example is the process of attaining food. First, man plants and grows a harvest of wheat and transforms that wheat into bread, which is a series of actions taken to produce a value. Then he eats the bread, which is the action of consuming the value. This is the basic pattern of his activity in relation to values, no matter how complex the actions and values involved. There is a hierarchical relationship among all of man's values. That is, the value which is the end of one action becomes the means for the achievement of another wider value. As, for instance, the consumption of bread is the end or goal of the activity of farming. But that consumption is the means of achieving a wider value, one's survival. Ultimately, all of man's activity, both production and consumption, has two basic final goals, two values which are not means to further ends, but are ends in themselves. The maintenance of his life and its enjoyment. This basic pattern of man's actions and existence has a corresponding pattern of actions within his consciousness. The activity of his consciousness also falls into two basic categories, two functions which constitute the production and the consumption of values, namely thought and emotion. In terms of consciousness, thinking is the activity of perceiving, identifying, and choosing values. Emotion is the activity of using them, of experiencing their meaning in relation to oneself. For instance, thinking is required to gain the knowledge, choose the standard, and identify the value of art. The emotion of pleasure which one experiences when one views a great work of art is one's use, that is, one's consumption, of the value made possible by one's thinking. A man who never chose to rise above the value level of a brute would not experience that pleasure. The fundamental principle in both realms of man's activity, in existence and in consciousness, is that all activity of production must result in a corresponding activity of consumption. Any significant discrepancy between these two activities leads to frustration and suffering. Since man is an integrated unit, and since all of his values and actions are interrelated, both functions of his consciousness, thought and emotion, are involved in all of his activities. He experiences emotional pleasure in the process of productive work, and his thinking is involved in any act of consuming. There can be no totally emotionless production nor totally mindless consumption. The difference between these two activities, then, is a difference in the focus of his concern. In productive activity, his concern is centered on his work. In consumption activity, his concern is centered on himself, on his own enjoyment. Production is the process of achieving a future value. Consumption is the enjoyment of a value already achieved. Now, in regard to man's simpler, short-range values, the relationship between the activity of production and the activity of consumption is simple and direct, such as the growing and eating of food or the making and wearing of clothes. But in regard to his wider, more intellectual, more abstract values, man has a problem. What is the form of consumption commensurate with the achievement of his great crucial long-range values. Psychologically, the pleasure of production is an emotional state accompanying a process of action in reality. But the pleasure of consumption is a positive emotional state, a state existing only inside his own consciousness, with no corresponding action or expression in reality. Where his minor values are concerned, a passive state of rest and satisfied contemplation is an appropriate and sufficient acknowledgement of a minor achievement. But in regard to his major values, in regard to achievements of crucial importance, man feels an intense desire to express his emotional consumption, his victory, his success, his happiness, in action. This desire comes from the need to give an objective form to his happiness, to bring it into reality, not to let it remain a private, subjective state, but to make it objectively real. All of you know the experience of saying or feeling, "I'm so happy I don't know what to do about it," or "I'm so happy I wish I could do something about it." This desire for action comes from the need to balance production and consumption, to bring one's consumption up to a level commensurate with the importance of the value achieved. Since values and action are so crucially interrelated, a value achieved by action and in objective reality demands consumption in action and in objective reality. A great achievement rewarded by nothing but the state of one's own inner consciousness is a frustration. It is in the metaphysical nature of a consciousness, any consciousness, to seek to express its efficacy, its power, its values outside in existence, in reality. This need, the need to objectify one's enjoyment, is filled, is answered by the concept of celebration. What is a celebration? A celebration is an action undertaken not as a means to an end, but as an end in itself. Not for the purpose of achieving a value in the future, but for the purpose of giving an objective expression to the enjoyment of a value achieved in the past, most often, but not necessarily, in the immediate past. A wedding is a celebration. A birthday party is a celebration. A party in honor of the achievements of a distinguished guest is a celebration. The 4th of July is a national celebration. That typically American holiday, Thanksgiving Day, captures the essence of a celebration, a holiday to celebrate the successful completion of a harvest. Every celebration is an act objectifying the pleasure of consumption after the successful production of a major value. Now I will remind you that man is a being of self-made soul, that of all the values he has to achieve by his own effort, the greatest and most crucial one is himself. That the achievement which makes all his other achievements possible is the creating of his own moral character, the achievement of the values proper to a rational being in his own person. This is the hardest, and in its perfect state, the rarest of all of man's productive achievements. And as such, it requires the greatest kind of consumption pleasure and the most intense form of enjoyment and celebration of it. A celebration which a man would desire the more passionately, the greater the value he has made of himself. What form of consumption pleasure and of celebration is open to man to objectify the value of his own person? That consumption pleasure is love. Its celebration is sex.